Let's try it now. Excellent. Welcome, everyone. Oh, see, I woke you guys up, didn't I? This is a little bit like being in a church. You know, everybody kind of spreads out. But there's not a lot of folks here, so if you would be comfortable and would like to come up here, we can make this a more intimate setting. If not, you know, that's okay, but I thought I would extend that offer. I would like to introduce you, without blowing this thing out and blowing out your ears, I would like to introduce Lisa Grady from Radiant Logic, Novato, California, who is going to talk to us this afternoon about building a flexible identity infrastructure for SharePoint. We've been talking with people throughout the conference during this week, and we've met a lot of very interesting people from a lot of different organizations, and they've had a lot of really interesting challenges. I think that Lisa's going to talk about those, so I think this is going to be pretty informative and hopefully entertaining as well. So Lisa and I were talking, and we were getting ready for this little introduction that I'm doing, and I said, you know, are there any anecdotes that you would like me to share with everyone in the audience? And she said, no, not really. But the couple of things that I do want to share about Lisa is that she's our product manager and one of our solution architects at Radiant Logic, and is one of the original people in the organization. She's been here for more than 14 years with Radiant Logic, and is one of the most knowledgeable people about our solution set. So with that, I'm going to get out of the way, and please extend a warm welcome to Lisa Grady.
Thank you. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. As Al had mentioned, I'm here to talk about how to build a flexible identity infrastructure for your SharePoint deployments, talk about some of the challenges that our customers have seen for deploying SharePoint, and how building a federated identity service infrastructure has helped them solve some of those challenges. During today's presentation, I'm going to be reviewing two of the most commonly used authentication authorization models that our customers are using within SharePoint, those being a forms-based authentication approach and a SAML token-based authentication approach. Some of the challenges around deploying either of these approaches in large enterprises where there are many heterogeneous data sources, some of those are having overlapping users across these data sources, incomplete profile information because the profile information is distributed in data sources other than Active Directory, having an incomplete view of groups. So if a user is spread across multiple data silos, multiple Active Directory domains, you lose the ability to have a complete list of groups that they're a member of in each of these distributed systems. And then I'm going to talk about some of the burden of static group management. So one of the big challenges our customers are facing is managing group memberships, defining them statically, so defining the member in the group and having to maintain these as users move from departments or leave the organization or are hired or change roles, et cetera. So I'll be talking about some of the benefits of having an infrastructure that allows you to move away from static groups and move towards more data-driven groups to authorize your users for your SharePoint sites. Our product, Radiant One, is the piece of infrastructure that will help you simplify authentication with SharePoint and help you evolve toward a more finer-grained, smarter authorization by giving you the flexibility of those data-driven groups that I had mentioned. All right. Again, the two common most authentication methods that our customers are using are forms-based, which leverages the SharePoint membership and role provider through the ASP.NET interface. It allows your users to log into the SharePoint sites based on a user and password typed into a form. The user's group information is then retrieved from the role provider so that SharePoint can properly authorize users on your site. And SharePoint supports LDAP sources out of the box, and our product provides an LDAP interface. So it provides a single source where SharePoint can authenticate users and then retrieve their group information. The other approach, a SAML token-based authentication approach, is where an identity provider issues a SAML token on behalf of users who authenticate, and SharePoint can accept that token as proof of authentication and then leverage the claims inside the token for authorizing the user on the site. Some of the challenges around authentication are best described when you break down actually what happens. During authentication, it's essentially two steps. The first step is you need to uniquely identify the person who's trying to access your site. When you have identities that are spread across multiple data sources, multiple Active Directory domains, and forests, this can be a challenge. Each data source is going to store that unique identifier differently, whether it's UID, SAM account name, a login. And more concerning are overlapping user accounts. So the same user has an identity in more than one source. So which source do you authenticate against and with which password? Next comes the credential checking. So after I've identified you, I need to validate your credentials. And this will vary depending on the source that you're authenticating against. It may be an LDAP bind. It may be validating a Kerberos session. So when you break it down into these two different steps and take a look at some of the challenges around each one, you can start to see where this can magnify if you've got heterogeneous multiple data sources in your environment. For authorization, when you do have overlapping user accounts, you get profile information spread across these different data sources. So being able to uniquely identify the person and then being able to pull the appropriate profile attributes from each system. Data sources have their own schema elements. So for groups within each type of data source in Active Directory, they're associated with a group object class and typically a member attribute. In a Sun LDAP directory, it would be group of unique names and the unique members. So the way that each data source maintains their groups, and even in some cases, nested groups. Some directories support a nesting of groups, and others support dynamic grouping, so requiring a client to issue an extra query to get the members based on a member URL. There was a recent Osterman study that indicated that typical Fortune 1000 companies who are the majority of our customers, have about a 20% turnover rate as people are hired or fired or promoted, assigned to new projects. And that 81% of these companies are manually maintaining these groups that are affected by this turnover. So there's a lot of time and money spent in maintaining these groups. So for that first step of authentication, being able to uniquely identify a person, here's some challenges that you could face. In the example shown on the left, well, let's see, your left, my right. We have a scenario where the same user has different identifiers. So in one data source, I have Lana identified as L. Landry, and in another source, she's Lana Landry. So if she logs into a SharePoint site, assuming that the zone she logged into points to the right data source, she might be able to be authenticated fine. But if I need to authorize Lana now, I'm going to have either a global profile of her or at least a list of all the groups that she's a member of. Over on the right-hand side, probably a more serious problem would be if you have the same identifier across data sources representing different people. So now you can start to see, now I need to disambiguate these overlapping identifiers to be able to distinguish between Sarah Matthews and Steve Matthews, because you don't want Sarah Matthews logging in as CEO and being authorized as the intern, Steve Matthews. So once you start talking about multiple data silos and being able to authenticate and authorize users in them, being able to differentiate and handle these types of challenges. This scenario is actually based on one of our customer deployments. And when you take a look at Active Directory domains, and even domains in the same forest, best practices is you don't have overlapping identities. But our customers haven't always followed best practices, and they end up with having accounts provisioned at the geographical location where the Active Directory domain is that they need to be able to access resources in. So they've ended up with the same account across multiple Active Directory domains. So I have my user, which is a little hard to see, but Johnny Appleseed here. And within each of these domains, he's a member of different groups. So he's obviously a member of groups in domain A, group A, because he needs to be able to be authorized to do things in this domain. And then in another domain, he's a member of group B. So you take a look at how this would affect a SharePoint deployment. My SharePoint's deployed in the SE3-1 domain and my user's in the Novato domain, assuming that the user's already been authenticated in this model. But if I log in from, if my user logs in into the Novato domain and accesses the SharePoint, SharePoint will authorize him based on the group he's a member of in the Novato domain, so group B. So if I've defined my SharePoint permissions based on group A, for example, and Johnny logs in, he's not going to be able to authorize with the proper group membership because I don't have a global view of all the groups he's a member of. So why do you need a federated identity service, and what the heck is it? When you look at, especially moving towards SaaS applications, and you have, obviously, typically on-premise legacy applications as well, they need to service users. And if everyone's neatly contained in one data source, it's generally not a problem. You provision users to that data source, and everybody authenticates and authorizes to it. In large organizations, that's never the case. There's always a lot of data sources that exist already. And having these applications service users in these data sources requires the application to be able to connect to those systems. A lot of applications can't even support more than one data source for authenticating users and authorizing users. So even though the diagram here shows the scenario that if they could, look at all the various different connections they would have to make, look at all the different schemas they'd have to understand, how to connect to the system, how to identify a user, how to authenticate a user, how do I handle the groups the user is a member of, do I need to flatten them, do I need to aggregate them, all of these different types of challenges in order to properly enforce security. When you look at deploying a federated identity service, an identity hub, the architecture becomes much cleaner. I now have this single central location where I can authenticate my users, identify them, authenticate them, and retrieve all their profile attributes in addition to all the groups that they're a member of. This gives me a lot of flexibility now because a lot of our customers are dealing with mergers and acquisitions or divestitures or consolidation efforts, migration efforts. So their data sources, shown on the bottom here, are changing. And with every data source change, you don't want that to have to directly impact your applications. So having a layer like this, you shield your applications from the complexity of the data sources. So you're able to do these mergers and acquisitions, acquiring new user populations, migrating away from some, consolidating some of your data sources, but yet your applications are not impacted. You don't have to make changes there because the abstraction layer with the identity service, the identity hub, shields them from that. They still continue to look in one place to authenticate users, authorize users in that one location as well. When you look at our solution, Radiant One, and this diagram is similar to the one on the last slide, but you can actually see the different components that make up our solution. At the heart of the architecture is the Virtual Directory Server, the VDS. And this is the abstraction layer that aggregates, correlates, acts as an identity hub for all your identities, in addition to being able to delegate credentials checking back to an authoritative source. So if you did want to have users log in with a user and password to your sites, and you wanted that authentication request to be directed to an LDAP or an Active Directory, a database or a web service, for example, the virtual directory component would delegate that credentials check to the appropriate backend, so you don't have to worry about synchronizing passwords all over the place. They can actually be verified against their authoritative source. And then within the identity hub, being able to maintain the reference links to all the data sources a user is in. First of all, that's going to be used for us to know how to go back to delegate their credential to begin with. But then that is also used for us to be able to join and be able to retrieve the profile attributes from the individual data silos and build that global profile that applications can then use to base authorization on. For native-speaking LDAP applications, they can connect to our virtual directory via LDAP. For SAML token aware applications, which would be noted with the little star on the bottom or the upper left corner, those would go through our Cloud Federation Service product, so CFS. And this piece is a token issuer, a token translation token issuer. It leverages the VDS, and we'll get into more of that in a minute, but it's basically integrated with the virtual directory server to be able to authenticate users, retrieve those profile attributes, because what goes inside of a token? Well, it's your identifier to prove you've authenticated, in addition to claims, and claims are attributes about you. So where does that information come from? CFS looks up the global profile in the virtual directory, which is pulling those attributes from a variety of backend systems. And then it'll package and translate the token and deliver it to whatever the consuming application would be. In today's presentation, obviously, that piece is SharePoint. So how does a product like this solve authentication challenges? As I mentioned, for authenticating users, there's the identification, how to find the unique user, and then being able to check his credentials. So the first step you need to do is be able to connect to all the different data sources, map them to a common name, map them to a common schema, be able to perform any kind of correlation if you do have user overlap and you want to be able to ensure that the overlapping users get linked properly, being able to have that unique central identity hub list, and then being able to delegate that credentials checking back to the authoritative sources that person is in. And also bringing in new user populations. You don't have to necessarily go and extend your SharePoint to another site or another zone. You can mount that new user population into your existing virtual directory, and then SharePoint can immediately start allowing access to these new sets of users. How do you build something like this? It all starts with your identities, being able to connect to the various different data silos, being able to build that unique list, which may require some correlation efforts to identify overlapping users. The next step, joining to build the global profile. Identify which attributes you care about that you need to either populate in a token or use to build a dynamic group of users. Once you have the global profile, then you can determine how you want to dispatch them into groups. Maybe you already have groups that are relevant for authorizing into SharePoint. Maybe you want more flexibility in terms of making those groups more data-driven based on user profile attributes. Even if you decide to make the groups more dynamic and data-driven, SharePoint can still consume them as a static group. You don't have to do anything different on your SharePoint site. You can go look up the group. It looks like a standard static LDAP group. And then map those to your SharePoint groups, your roles for your site. You don't have to do any heavy customization on SharePoint site. Step four would be caching, because obviously this is all great, being able to aggregate and correlate and dynamically build groups and all these different computations, but you need to be able to do that fast. If you can't deliver the security information fast, it's not going to do you any good. So having an effective caching strategy is also going to be important. One thing with Radiant 1 is there's also an automatic refresh strategy. So when changes happen in your underlying data sources, the cache gets updated automatically. If your profile attributes change for your user, they can automatically be assigned to those new groups, and then the cached images will be updated accordingly. This diagram basically shows the steps involved. So the first thing is the data sources themselves. You have existing data sources, and being able to extract and inventory the metadata from each of those systems is important, because with this step, you can begin to understand and learn how an identity is stored there. How is it, what object class is it associated with? If it's a database table, what attributes are available to me in that database? This is important. So the schema extraction process is actually what drives the whole model, the whole virtualization model. Because with this information, not only can I use it to define my correlation logic, I also use it to define which profile attributes I want to pull from which source. This also allows me to build different virtual views, different images of my information to a variety of different applications. So obviously today, the consumer of these views would be SharePoint, but with a layer like this, you can build many different dynamic views off of your data. So I can have a view that I use to initialize Salesforce or another application. I can have a view for SharePoint. I can have a view for many different applications. So this layer that you're putting in place can be reused for lots of different initiatives. So let's take a look at a very simple example of some correlation, what that means. So I have three systems here, A, B, and C, and overlapping users in some. The goal behind correlation is to be able to uniquely identify overlapping users. If I don't already have an attribute in common that I can use, you can define some correlation rules. Now I'm going to use a very simple example here to define what that means. If I were to take the first name and last name attribute and concatenate it with an underscore from system A, and from system B, concatenate given name and SN, and from system C, concatenate first name, last name. It's rarely this simple, by the way. But at the end, what I would have is a complete, unique list of all my users. So I can see now that I don't have a Laura Callahan showing up twice in my list. I have one Laura Callahan. But I also maintain her local identifiers. So just because I have this unique hub now, I also have a reference point to go back and uniquely identify her in that specific system. With this linking back functionality, like I mentioned, I can now go back and uniquely identify Laura in System A to authenticate her. Check the credentials there. I can also indicate in my view definition if I want to pull some of her attributes from there to build my global profile. So title, group, role, for example, role and group coming from System C, title coming from System B. So once I get this unique list of identities, it's the basis for being able to authenticate users, join, build global profiles, go back to those systems and build an aggregated list of groups that the user is a member of. All of this to support your security, your authentication, and your authorization with SharePoint. So if you remember my Johnny Appleseed user in the beginning, having the two accounts in the different Active Directory domains, it's a little hard to see here, but this would be a sample of my virtual view that would correlate Johnny Appleseed, return him one time in my view, my list here. But when I look at his profile, the member of attribute here is now a list, a complete list of the groups that he's a member of in all of those domains. So now I have group A and group B. The applications are none the wiser at this point. They just have a complete list of groups that now they can determine authorization on. Leading into, how does Radiant One solve authorization challenges? As I've mentioned, if it's an attribute based, if an application is determining and enforcing authorization based on a user's profile attributes, being able to identify users, join, build, bring those profile attributes from multiple systems to deliver the complete profile to the application. Groups-based, being able to aggregate existing groups, being able to offer a flexible way to define and manage your groups, and I'll be getting to that shortly, but basically, instead of statically maintaining my group members, I can build the group members dynamically based on a set of profile attributes. And then lastly, leveraging this identity and group layer for other initiatives. So I mentioned this before, but if I didn't have a layer like this in place, and some applications have evolved and offer some flexibility in terms of connecting to more than one source, doing some identity mapping, being able to look up attributes in more than one system maybe, but it's really not their core service. It's not their business. It's like they've tried to provide a little flexibility here and there, and it may work. It may be sufficient in some scenarios, but having to do that and maintain it for each application of yours doesn't make sense. So having a layer that's specialized in identity and group integration to provide those complete user profiles, those complete lists of groups, being able to auto-generate groups and have groups be groups contain members from many different systems even. So having this layer that's specialized in this task and then just delivering the view to the applications that need it, it's much more efficient. It's going to help you evolve as well. So putting this layer in place allows you to share it across many different initiatives. So let's take a look at some examples of what I'm talking about when I mention auto-generated or dynamic grouping. The first example shown here is taking three different existing directories in this case, and with the virtual directory component at the top, just aggregating. There doesn't even have to be any user overlap necessarily to find value here. So in the scenario here, there's no user overlap, but what I gain here is my applications have a single place to look for the users and the groups the users are a member of. Within an LDAP directory, when you have static members defined, it's a DN, and that DN references the user entry in that contained source. When the VDS aggregates lots of different sources, now the namespace has changed. You can see that where the users are located up in the virtual directory tree are different than how they actually exist on the back end. But deploying our layer isn't as much work as involved here because we can actually automatically translate the member DN to match the new namespace that you're using. So for example, I have John is a member of the marketing group down here in Active Directory US domain, and he's identified by CN John, OU People, DC US, obviously matching the hierarchy. Mounted in the virtual directory namespace, however, he's now identified as CN John, OU People, OU AD1, O equal VDS. So the automatic translation between the member DNs from the backends to the virtual namespace happens automatically for you. In this example, it's showing a same user account existing in the three different backends. I have Andrew Fuller in an LDAP, an Active Directory, and a database in this case. I don't have a single unique identifier, but based on the metadata information and how I know an identity is stored in each data silo, I can start to set up some correlation rules to allow me to build what I've called the correlated identity view on the top right. So I have a complete profile, a unique entry, Andrew Fuller, with his complete profile, with attributes pulled from each of the data sources. And then based on this complete profile, I'm able to build what I've called a dynamic groups view, shown on the top left. So any user that has clearance level of 1, title of VP sales, and a region of PA is automatically assigned to a PA sales group. Now to take it one step further, you'll notice that I've also have a member of attribute in the identity view. Some applications base authorization by looking up into a group to see if a user is a member. Some applications can look up into a user entry to see if they have the group in their member of attribute. So just because I'm dynamically generating these groups and I can make the group appear as a static LDAP group, you can also have that referential integrity between the group and the user in the user entry itself. So I can easily compute the member of and return a member of attribute in the user profile. So no matter how an application may need to determine your group membership, they can be accommodated with these two different types of views. Here's another example similar to my Johnny Appleseed one. Two different Active Directory domains. The same user has an account in each. Being able to first identify the user and build that correlated identity view in that global profile. And then just view a list of existing groups that the user is a member of. And the last example here is showing how across three different data silos, I can take an attribute, like department in this scenario, and auto-generate group names and members based on that department. So if I aggregate and consolidate a list of all the possible departments contained in the database, the Active Directory, the LDAP directory, I can come up with a list of a group named HR, marketing, and sales. Each of the users now can come from any of the data silos, and they're assigned to the group accordingly based on which department they're a member of. So if I have a user that changes a department, they would automatically get reallocated into a new group and removed from the original group. So again, these are just some ways that you can alleviate the need to have that static group being maintained by an administrator, making your groups more data-driven based on attributes. What's nice about having an infrastructure that's devoted to identity and group integration tasks is there's a whole set of tools and wizards to help you build these different views. We've taken a lot of time to go through some of the most common scenarios that our customers have faced and packaged wizards to help guide you through the configuration process. So for example, building a correlated identity view, that unique list across different data silos, can be done with the virtual identity wizard. The previous groups examples that I've shown to you can be achieved using the Groups Builder tool. Oftentimes, things aren't always so easy, so having the need to define more advanced correlation rules or even more advanced virtual views can be done through our other tools. So we have wizards for more common scenarios, and then we have more low-level tools that allow you to go in and tinker and define some more complex correlation logic and things like that. I mentioned this before, but having a smart caching mechanism at the level of the identity service is important. And the architecture shown here gives you a little glimpse about how the automatic refresh happens. There's different ways to refresh your cache. It doesn't always have to be an automated scenario like that's defined here. If your data only changes once a day and you know that, do you really care about detecting it once that change happens? Maybe not. You may just want to schedule a refresh once a day. So this is the more advanced scenario where you want to be notified. Real-time change detection. If you have a user that gets fired or moves departments and you want to make sure that that user no longer has access to SharePoint or whatever, that's something you want to make sure you detect right away, and that would get your cache image refreshed. Basically, how it works is there are different change detection mechanisms. So depending on what type of data source you're pulling information from, if it's a database, for example, we can leverage triggers or even a timestamp-based connector to detect a change. We also offer a snapshot-based connector where we can go and periodically build snapshots of your data to check for changes. So if you don't want to have triggers installed on your database, the snapshot mechanism is always available to you. For LDAP directories, we can leverage a changelog or persistent search method if that's supported on the LDAP. For Active Directory, we can leverage the USN change number or even Active Directory event log. Certain directory activities, there's a subcategory of directory services in the event log that we can actually detect changes from there. Once that change is picked up, all of it flows through a messaging queue layer. So this is for the guaranteed message delivery. If the target were down for some reason, if the virtual directory were down, you wouldn't lose your cache refreshes. They would be queued inside the JMS, and then once the VDS comes back online, those changes will continue through to update the cache image. So the JMS layer and the application layer that you see here, that's just for guaranteed message delivery. So once the change is detected down here at number one, the VDS is notified that there's been a change and which entries have changed. Now, multiple different views can be built off the same data sources. So the VDS maintains a list of cache dependencies, so it knows all of the branches that are going to be affected by this change in your backend. So it will go and it will refresh all those branches accordingly. That's happening at steps 3 and step 4 here. Okay, I want to take some time and just show you the configuration, because all of this sounds great, but if it's really complex to set up, it's not too appealing. So let's take a quick look at the configuration and the end user experience. As I mentioned in the beginning, SharePoint has out-of-the-box functionality to connect to an LDAP server through their membership and their role provider. So you can point SharePoint to the Radiant1, the VDS component, and it can leverage it for authenticating users and gathering the group information, profile information from the directory. On the back end, as I mentioned, the information can actually be coming from a variety of different backend systems. So as what I was talking about, when you can bring in a new user population quickly, I can basically just mount another data source down here, connect it to my user identity hub, and then SharePoint can immediately authenticate and authorize those users. When you take a look at the flow of actually what happens on Forms-based, I have my sample user over here. Step 1, the user accesses the SharePoint site. 2, for Forms-based, SharePoint would prompt the user with a form where they can enter in user and password. Step three would be sending the user and password to SharePoint. Step four would be SharePoint connecting to the virtual directory to send the credentials checking and validate the user. Step five, once the user is authenticated, there'll be a lookup to determine what groups that user is a member of, so SharePoint can properly enforce authorization. And then lastly, in step six, the user is returned to the site with whatever permissions they've been defined. Obviously, on the Radiant One side, you have to build your virtual view. So we'd use those wizards or tools that I'd mentioned, get your identity hub in place, and then on the SharePoint side, you would define the membership and role provider in the site configuration. And then that would correspond to a web config file where you would indicate the connection to the VDS. So the membership provider for the authentication, and then the role provider would be where you would define how to look up a group, essentially. What does a user see when they access the SharePoint site? The form. Now you can obviously customize your forms in SharePoint. I think this is the default one. Also, the screenshots you'll see today are 2010, but everything I'm talking about here is also valid with 2013. So bringing up the form, the user enters in a user and password. SharePoint will identify, in my case, Andrew Fuller here, logging in the Radiant One VDS and authenticate that user. And then once they're authenticated, the group lookup will happen. And based on what groups the user is found to be a member of, SharePoint will authorize the user to the site. So that was for forms-based. The other authentication method that a lot of our customers are, I think, moving toward, at least maybe not now, but in the near-term future, is SAML token-based authentication. So SharePoint trusting our Cloud Federation Service component as the trusted token issuer. And CFS is built and integrated with the Radiant One VDS component. But that's not the only authentication choice you have when you take this route. You can also authenticate with Facebook or Twitter or Google, or if you're logged into an Active Directory domain already, CFS can validate your login against that Active Directory domain, so you can have a single sign-on experience into SharePoint. CFS does leverage the VDS to do any kind of forms-based authentication. And it also leverages the VDS to retrieve the profile attributes and the group information. So CFS is building that token, remember, the fact that you've authenticated, in addition to which attributes you have that are going to be populated into claims that SharePoint will then later enforce authorization on. So if you go through the flow here, when a user accesses SharePoint through their browser, and they're not already authenticated, they don't already have a token, SharePoint will redirect the user to, in this case, CFS, the trusted token issuer for the site. CFS will validate the user, and as I mentioned, it could be through a variety of different mechanisms, Formspace, Twitter, Google, or a Windows authentication through the domain that they might be currently logged into. The token will be, then the information about the user will be packaged into the token and sent to the user with a redirect back to the SharePoint site, which happens in step six here. SharePoint will leverage the information in the token to confirm you are authenticated and then determine how to authorize you based on either the claims values that came in or some claims augmentations to get more information about you at that time. So for the CFS configuration, as I mentioned, that comes integrated with the virtual directory. It leverages it for any kind of forms-based authentication. So if you have a user who's not logged into a known Active Directory domain, and maybe they're remote or from their mobile device, they would generally use a forms-based approach. Enter in that user and password. CFS will leverage the VDS to do the credentials checking, and then it will pull the profile information and group information from the VDS, and it will package that information inside the token. To support the Windows integrated authentication, you would just define your Active Directory domains inside CFS, and we'll take a look at what that configuration entails. But this allows users who, as long as they're logged in, maybe to their desktop in the morning into a known secure domain, CFS can identify that and validate the user's Windows session, and then not prompt them for logging in or providing any other credentials at that time. On the SharePoint side, you would need to set up the CFS as a trusted identity provider. And also, there's a custom claims provider that you can set up within in SharePoint as well. And this will allow you to validate claims values to search and resolve within the People Picker. And I'll show you an example of that. So they really come hand in hand, because once you start working with SharePoint and SAML-based authentication, using the default People Picker, it's tricky, because when you're searching for a user, you can basically type in whatever you want, and there's no validation against a SAML. That SharePoint doesn't know where the identity is coming from, so they can't search and validate whatever you put in there is actually legit. So having that custom claims provider with inside SharePoint to allow you to validate the claim value that might be coming in is helpful here. So those two setups are what would be required inside of SharePoint. On the CFS side, being able to support Windows authentication against the different Active Directory sites would actually leverage what we call our Radiant Trust Connector. So what you see here in the diagram in the pink for each forest, one Radiant Trust Connector per forest. And what it would do is, when a user is detected from coming from that domain or being logged into that domain, CFS will basically leverage the RTC to validate that user's credentials inside that domain, their Windows authentication. Then the RTC component will package a token validating that, yes, this person is been identified and authenticated, and then we'll send it back to CFS. CFS will then take that identifier, look it up inside the VDS, get the profile attributes, package it in the token, and then send it back, send the user back to the application they're trying to log into. So you set up these different Radiant Trust connectors within the CFS console here, which is this what this is showing. At the top, you would indicate the domain name. And then down here, the identification rules is, once the user has been validated, how do you want to look up that user in the VDS? So obviously, there would have to be some connection between the VDS and the Active Directory domain that the user is being authenticated against to be sure you have that identifier in common. But in this case, it's mapping, hard to see there, CN. So you can set up your Active Directory domains, and then you can also set up the connection to the VDS you want CFS to point to for the forms-based authentication and then retrieving the profile attributes from. So setting that up. And then you need to define SharePoint as the service provider or relying party. And what this entails is identifying which attributes you want to populate in the claims. In this example, it's populating male and member of as in the role claim. On the SharePoint side, you can use PowerShell to identify and configure CFS as a trusted identity token issuer. And then within the SharePoint site, you would just enable that site to support CFS as the trusted IDP. And then, as I mentioned, that custom claims provider allowing you to override or add additional functionality to the default People Picker, so that when you actually type in to find somebody, search for somebody that you want to apply authorization to, it will actually perform a search against the virtual directory to validate that information actually exists. It's a legitimate value. Otherwise, an admin could come in and type in whatever they wanted to and claim that might come in the role claim when it may not even be something legitimate. So having the custom claims provider helps with the search and resolve from People Picker, and it also helps for claims augmentation. So if what came inside the token from CFS, if SharePoint needed more information about the user to authorize them, they could do claims augmentation based on what you can define here on which attributes you want to go and retrieve custom claims about, more information about the user, essentially. So if you take a look at a SAML-based, token-based authentication, if I have a user in, again, my Novato domain over here, when the user accesses the SharePoint site, assuming they don't already have a valid SharePoint token, they would be redirected to CFS. So that happens in step 3. CFS, noting that the user's coming from the Novato domain, would redirect the user to the local RTC, that trust component that I mentioned, that would actually do the validation of the user's Windows authentication. And so this is the authentication step for the user. Now, the user, the browser, would redirect, and with that valid authentication token, to CFS in step 7 here. CFS will identify the user in VDS. VDS is virtualizing both of the Active Directory domains in each of the domains here. So I get that global view of groups, global all the profile attributes, and then packages the token that's required and requested from SharePoint and sends the user back, redirects the user back to the SharePoint site. The user then delivers that token to SharePoint in step 10, and then SharePoint leverages the contents of the token to authorize the user. So as long as the user's logged into a valid Active Directory domain, a known Active Directory domain by CFS, they experience single sign-on into the SharePoint site. It's a little hard to see here, too, but it's actually showing the token that was received from CFS for Johnny Appleseed, and I can see the role claim is populated with that member of value that I showed you previously in the Virtual Directory Global Profile. And then in this scenario, no matter which domain Johnny Appleseed were to log into, either the SC tree or the Novato domain, he would get single sign-on, and he would also have the same permissions enforced on SharePoint. For remote users who aren't logged into an Active Directory domain or from a mobile device, you can use a forms-based approach. So this is just an example of some of the different devices that some of our customers are using. One last value prop of having this complete global profile is you can leverage the VDS as the source to populate the SharePoint user profile database. So for SharePoint, their whole My Sites functionality, which will allow you to expose certain attributes about yourself to allow your colleagues to find you, collaborate with you, share documents with you. SharePoint has to have a piece of your profile stored with them to drive this functionality. So once you've went through the effort of doing the identity correlation, reconciliation, and building your global profile, now you can leverage the VDS as a source for syncing into the SharePoint user profile database. So back to my story of Andrew Fuller here, I have that correlated identity view, and now that can be used, one or more, all of the attributes that you want to essentially, to populate into the SharePoint user profile database. And this sync process is actually built into SharePoint. So it's their user profile service application. You would configure synchronization, point to the VDS if it's using forms-based, or CFS if it were using the SAML token-based authentication. And then this would read the profile from the virtual directory and then synchronize it to the user profile database in SharePoint. Okay. Quick summary, and then if anybody has any questions, I'll take questions in a moment. Evolve your SharePoint easily. When you put in place this type of infrastructure, being able to have a single logical place to authenticate, authorize your users, bring in new user populations quickly without requiring changes on SharePoint, and then being able to consume this information through either as an LDAP directory or through a SAML token, you can evolve your SharePoint easily. Improve security, so those advanced auto-generated groupings that I talked about today allows you to deliver this information to SharePoint as static groups. Saving time, you're simplifying the management of your users and your groups. You can reduce potentially the number of SharePoint zones to manage, reduce the static group management on your data source side. And then obviously being able to have one source for SharePoint to synchronize into their user profile database. Any kind of custom data requirements that you might have, being able to do that at a layer that's specialized for this as opposed to having to try to tweak something at SharePoint, allows SharePoint to just focus on the efforts and the services it's providing, the collaboration, and not have to be in the business of data integration. And lastly, you're maximizing your return on your investment, because as I mentioned, this platform you're putting in place, can be used for SharePoint, but it doesn't stop there. You're putting it in place to be able to build different views to serve different applications' needs. So I've just given some examples here of what some of our customers are using in addition to SharePoint. Cisco Unified Communications Manager, Kumu, SiteMinder, basically any application that supports an LDAP directory or is claims aware and can accept a SAML token for authentication and authorization. And that's it. Thank you guys for hanging with me. If you have any questions, I can address them now. We do have a booth here at the conference. It's 1929, but apparently they're not numbered, I found. So if you want me to escort you over to our booth, I'd be happy to. Go ahead. Well, I wouldn't call it a single sign-on because you have to sign on. Well, it is a single sign. You have to sign on at least once. If you're not logged into an Active Directory domain that's known, you have to provide a form, log in through a form. Say that one more time, I'm sorry. Right. A form. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, Kim, do you have any in terms of, I mean,
that's always a dilemma trying to handle external
users. Right. Right. And when they log in, it's just
add that as a trusted domain, then they would just sail right through.
Yeah. Right.
Still,
if it's
like we'd still have to manage. Are you talking about like their local environment?
No, you said you create a separate domain.
If it's a separate Active Directory domain that they're logging into,
right,
then if you're using a SAML token-based approach, then they could experience single sign-on.
Yeah, the goal would be to get rid of that domain.
Oh.
Impossible.
Right. You're talking about the data sources themselves in different environments. We would need to connect through firewall. You have to open a firewall port to like an LDAP port if it was an LDAP server. An Active Directory, it could be 636 or 3268 if you wanted the global catalog. So there would just have to be some LDAP connection to that remote source for us to get to. Right. Right. Exactly. Right.
The point of that is that's better than creating accounts in more than one domain.
Right.
Yeah, I think that helps us with our European accounts.
And if you didn't want to expose necessarily those Active Directory domains across the net, you could put a virtual directory at those locations to have them virtualize the act. You could have the virtual directory in the DMZ, for example, and have them virtualize the Active Directories, and then that virtual directory can be mounted into other virtual directory views.